Sven Burkitz, literary critic, writer, in your lair at the journal Agni inside Boston University, you were very nearly present at the creation of Infinite Jest 20 plus years ago. But I wish you'd start from where we are today. How did David Foster Wallace's masterpiece become a classic, a mark of the era, sort of a touchstone for a generation? And are you ready by now to call it a great book?
I think it's a book with a huge amount of great writing and great influence. And the only place one might hold back on that greatness question is whether it realizes itself formally. And one of the big arguments by the critics has always been that, well, he launches these three massive, intricate lines and at the end, in a sense, doesn't bring them together. He himself was not a fan or proponent of closure, so it becomes one of those strange aesthetic debates. But I would say on the basis of the prose and on the influence of the prose and the influence of Wallace on several generations of writers that are now trailing after and manifesting things that he opened up, I'd say it's got to be the most influential book of his generation, if not the greatest.
Put it simply, on a Moby Dick scale, on a Huck Finn scale, where is it?
Well, if those are tens, then it would be our contemporary eight in an era when there's not much that would be a ten anyway. I think it is of the ilk of Moby Dick, because what it sets out to do is not to tell a story, but in a sense almost to create a literary environment, a kind of culture, and I think it succeeds very much at doing that. It's a product of complete compulsion and obsession, and I think it is a realization of obsession, and I think that's part of the reason it has such a tremendous kind of suction pull on people. I think even people who don't fully finish it or dabble in it, but they also recognize the power of that. And so other names you could throw out, again, we're not measuring, for the ages, but, you know, there's a Dostoevskian kind of intensity in places and a Kafkaesque obsessiveness. And those are all qualities that are streaming through that book. He's a badge people wear. They like to wear it for a host of reasons. There is the, tragic conflagration of the hugely gifted person who crashed in his life. He was a wonderful channel for obsessive anxiety, which you could say is part of the temper of our times. And if anyone caught it for his generation and the ones on either side, it was probably Wallace.
Sven Burkitz, tell us your David Foster Wallace story. It's long and interesting.
Yeah, and it goes back a ways. Sort of fell into my lap. I was writing monthly column for a short-lived magazine called Wigwag back in 1989, and one of my mandates was to scout out things that were a little bit off the obvious track. So I remember being in the Harvard bookstore and just looking at new books and picking up His Girl with Curious Hair and opening it, and right away having this feeling that, well, this was something a little different, something I might want to take a look at, read it and decided it was utterly unique, something I could happily spin a column around. And so I did this. I didn't realize at the time that he was actually living, a mile or two down the road. This was the period when he was doing, he's going back to school in philosophy. He was at Harvard. The review came out, and then a note came in the mail saying how much he had enjoyed the review, and he sees that I'm local, and maybe we could meet for coffee. So we met at the Pamplona. We met outside, sort of one of these, how will I know it's you? And he said, well, I'm very tall. I remember a thin, sandy-haired guy who was just smoking furiously, and those were the days when you could smoke inside the Pamplona, and we went in, and half of what I remember is him smoking, being very nice, very young, very cordial. He had manners that went back to an earlier era almost, which was in such interesting distinction to his, other complicated attitudes and vices and, everything else. But he was such a sweet and polite person. And that's what I remember about being on that show when Cynthia Ozick called in on your program, and he wanted to be sure to be able to talk to her. And I had to leave, and I was waving to him, and he was saying, "Yes, Miss Ozick, yes, Miss Ozick." And I thought, what a polite fellow. You know, there's a deferentiality there. It was just shocking to me, almost. Something he and I shared and were fascinated by, and it very much had to do with a kind of sense that he really got the way in which media, entertainment, and computers had, in a very short space, transformed everything. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was a lot of what he was bringing to the novel. And I thought that was a huge part of the attraction to me of Girl with Curious Hair, is that he had such a strange, antic, comic take on things like Jeopardy and Dave Letterman. He was obsessed with the media and the ironization of American culture, and that seemed to filter into a lot of what he was, on the one hand, writing very, you know, serious contemporary fiction. On the other hand, he was obsessed with playing with ironic inflection and doing it very intelligently. And then he had that essay called E Unibus Plurum, which was about television and how television had completely changed the literary landscape. And I know that he and I wrote back and forth a little bit about that.
Those are two very important themes. One thing, the whole arc in his life and his interest in irony and sort of getting over it, bathing in it, just, you know, being immersed in an ironic culture, and then saying, no, we gotta get someplace else. We gotta get back to life.
Well, yeah, and he had a wonderful phrase for that. He thought we had reached a terminal place with kind of double entendre, and he wanted to get back to single entendre values, but how to do that once you'd gone as far along as we all had culturally down the pathways of irony and self-reflectiveness. So I think he was battling that all along.
But isn't part of the moral of the whole story that you have to go through recovery? You have to go with suffering people to get back to human basics.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think there are two, one is the aspect that played in his life, which I can't testify to because I didn't know him that well. But I think he found in recovery and in the sort of culture at the bottom kind of a wonderful place to begin to locate a way out from endless cleverness.
Yeah.
And so he played those off. That's why I think the book was kind of wonderful, even if it didn't fall into a classical mode of resolving things climactically. I thought it was like, it's almost more like an enormous Caldermobile, where these very disparate things are in balance and in some kind of suspension, and they each sort of weigh off of each other, and yet there's no place where one sort of wins out at the end.
Yeah. So we're all fascinated and impressed in a way by the fact that this novel has been adopted by a generation, and so many people will testify to the meaning of it in their lives. At the same time, I think, holy mackerel, that's a grim, gruesome account of a time. It's all about suffering people in a rich country, addicted people, troubled in every way, a lot of them suicidal, as he in the end was. I mean, what does that tell you? This is not that we should, you know, be embracing Rebecca of Sunnybrook Farm or something, but it's a kind of warning, isn't it? That this is the novel of the last 20 years and maybe for the next 50 years.
Yeah, it's tricky, and I often wonder what it is that people are attaching themselves to when they attach themselves to that book. And I'm not always sure that it is what you're saying, though that's so definitely kind of the core content of it. But I think there's a way in which he combines various qualities. He makes kind of a high level of almost nerdish intelligence palatable and kind of hip, and he does it through a stance, a kind of jargon, a self-deprecatory thing where he can deprecate his intelligence even as he's manifesting it. I keep coming back to this notion that it's this particular collision of many strains of opposites that Wallace somehow pulls together, you know, high-mindedness and the tragic and the hugely comic, but also, as you were just saying, I mean, the vision of what he's looking at, so much of it is bleak and without horizon, and it's this voice. I mean, we haven't used the word voice here, but if you just start open the book and start reading any one of his riffs,
yeah,
and you get lost in the voice, and it is just, you know, this astonishing sort of downhill tumble, but under high control. And so, yeah, I think in a way he's a whole generation saying, yeah, we are kind of crazy, but we're also really smart. And we're smart in really strange ways that you may not know about. And David Foster Wallace is our man.
Well said, Sven Burkitz. Thank you.
With pleasure.